I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk about new efforts from the Indiana Governor's Council for People with Disabilities and ongoing work from that group. My guests are Christine Dahlberg, Executive Director of the Indiana Governor's Council for People with Disabilities, and Richard Probst, Governor's Council Spokesperson. Please join the conversation. You can call us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI, or you can track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today about some new efforts by the Indiana Governor's Council for People with Disabilities and, of course, the ongoing efforts of that group to fully integrate people with disabilities into our workforce and society. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. My guests today are one veteran, Christine Dahlberg, who is Executive Director of the Indiana Governor's Council for People with Disabilities, and one rookie, Richard Probst, Governor's Council Spokesperson. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
It's good to have you here. So I'll start with you, Christine. Since we've talked about new efforts, could you talk about what some of the new initiatives of the Governor's Council are?
Oh, sure. I'd be happy to. I think one of our most exciting new initiatives is a focus on employing people with disabilities. And as a very small government agency, we don't have a lot of money. We primarily use it to fund grants and materials and do some advocacy training, that kind of thing. And for our Employment First project, which is focused on just educating the public that people with disabilities want to work, they can work, and there's lots of ways that needs to be encouraged, both in state policy and local policy. So we have about 10 different coalitions that are being developed around the state to work on our Employment First initiative, all led by adults with disabilities who either have or want regular jobs in the community. So it's one of my current favorite projects because there's just such an enthusiasm among the folks that have come to those meetings for figuring out, you know, there's so many barriers to work for people with disabilities. So they come together to try to list those barriers and then figure out how we can remove them and what they can do at a local level as well as at the state and possibly federal level to really promote employment of people with disabilities. So that's a really cool project.
Richard, what are some of those barriers that that Christine talked about employment for people with disabilities?
Well, you know, I think one of the ones that gets the most attention, and it's an ongoing issue, is transportation. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think here in Indianapolis, you know, one of the biggest barriers that someone with a disability has is, you know, if they can't drive or if they don't have someone within their support system who can get them where they need to go, you know, how are they going to have that happen? You know, we have Indigo here locally, and yet, let's face it, that's challenged. And so that's a big barrier. I mean, being able to get to work, go from work, and do everything that's involved in maintaining a job. It's transportation, I think, is the biggest barrier. And, you know, I think a lot of people are worried about how it's going to affect their daily life. You know, the potential loss of benefits, potential issues with health care. And so what's exciting is looking at how the system is starting to address that. And again, the Governor's Council is a big part of that in making sure that people have access to the information that's out there, to the things that the system has developed, you know, Social Security,
Work incentives.
Work incentives.
MedWorks, which is a system where you can make a pretty substantial amount of money and still retain your Medicaid if you need it, which many people with disabilities need Medicaid because regular insurance doesn't pay for personal care assistance, for example. And so they can retain their Medicaid by paying a premium. And there's just so many things that people need to know about when they're thinking about returning to work with a disability. That makes it easy. And, well, never completely easy, but makes it a lot easier and can reassure people that, you know, you can have a chance to try to work without fearing that if you're not successful, that you'll be just dumped out and have no resources.
To grasp your point on saying it's not easy, I was reminded of something my grandfather told me once. He said that you realize that if, you know, the job you were doing was all fun, you would be paying them rather than having them pay you. So,
well,
you know, that
yeah.
there's work.
That's a good point.
There's
work
actual
work.
There's work involved here.
Well, so, you know, there's about 34% of adults in Indiana that are working age with disabilities, only 34% work. And that's compared to almost 80% of people without disabilities in employment age work. So there's a huge gap there. And we're not going to be able to address that gap entirely. But what we want to do is just really try to promote the possibilities, both to adults with disabilities and to businesses and communities.
Well, and I wanted to, you know, it seems to me, and this has been very valuable because it illustrates, it seems to me, several challenges here. One of them that I'm hearing, you know, at a practical level that Richard identified was transportation, but behind that is also just educating people about, you know, and the education piece is critical. I think that's going to be a larger piece. So I want to deal with this transportation question because I think it also takes us into an area that shows that the solutions may, you know, like here in a major city like Indianapolis or the other urban areas in Indiana, mass transit might be a solution of some kind for the transportation problem.
Yes.
But there are parts of Indiana where there isn't population density enough really to make mass transit feasible. And there are still people with disabilities who live there.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, when we look at this, how flexible do these support systems have to be? I'll start with Christine first.
They have to be a lot more flexible than they are. Let's put it that way. I mean, people could possibly get Aunt Sue to drive them to work, but Aunt Sue's going to need a little money for gas and maybe some money for her time, and the system's not set up to support Aunt Sue taking her nephew to work or her niece. Uber and Lyft are another example of something that might work for a lot of people, but there's no way for the system to pay for Uber and Lyft. However, if you do have a job and you set aside money in a savings account that doesn't count against your benefits or anything, you can potentially pay for things like that directly yourself. It's just getting it set up so that you have sufficient money to get yourself started. And you have income coming in to continue to support what you need to work. People could pay for some of their own supports, but not right out of the box, not before they get their first or even their first couple months of paychecks. So you know, there's some things that I think could be done that would really improve the way things are. And we're working on it. Richard and I and a whole bunch of other people are sitting on several different committees looking at some of those very issues and what we can do to promote employment and what are the barriers. And I have to agree with him. Transportation is the top one every time.
But what Christine's referring to here is kind of an initiation challenge, that it gets easier to negotiate. You know, the challenge is this, you know, the system once you're in it, but until you get in it, Richard, it sounds like that's not just a barrier. It's almost like a barricade.
Well, you know, when you think of, you know, again, that number of what, 34%,
right.
Was it 34%? And that means that, you know, there's this huge population of working age adults with disabilities who either are not working, are not aware that they can work, are not they don't have access to the tools that would help them go to work.
Mm-hmm.
And they have, again, as you mentioned, that lack of education of what's out there. And, you know, even with transportation, I mean, you have to learn the local system. You have mm-hmm. to learn about Indigo.
Well, that assumes there is a local system,
If there is a local system. Yeah. Now, there are other cities here, even in Indiana, that are smaller than Indianapolis, that do have some options. Mm-hmm. But, again, you get out into rural Indiana, and you're right. You know, you're depending on, you know, a family member, a friend, or anything like that, or some other kind of transportation. And that's why, you know, the solutions that we're going to come up with are going to have to be creative solutions.
Right.
I mean, that's it. You know, there's no cookie cutter that's going to fit the situation. I was in a situation, you know, when I first started working, and I'm a paraplegic in a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. When I first started working, I depended on Indigo.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I did Indigo for a couple of years. It didn't really work very well for me. But what it did was it did, in fact, give me enough time that I could create that savings, get into the workforce, learn the system. And actually, I found out that you could actually adapt a car pretty easily.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhat affordably. And so I started accessing that system. And now I drive.
Mm-hmm.
So, but again, I had to learn that system.
Mm-hmm. And that were there things along the way, Richard, that could have been done to expedite or accelerate that learning curve for you?
You know, I've been in the workforce for about 25 years, and I can, you know, a lot of the things that we have now, we did not have then, like the MedWorks programs.
Right.
Social Security didn't have someone who would kind of walk you through the process. So I made all kinds of mistakes entering the workforce. Just in terms of, you know.
Could you give us some examples of what you considered a mistake?
With Social Security, for example, they give you this probationary period where you can go back to work, you can try it. Well, during that time, I reported to them that I was going to try to go back to work, and then suddenly I saw some changes in my check, and I didn't understand it, and so I ended up having to get this huge overpayment,
mm-hmm.
and I had to pay back a bunch of money because I didn't realize that they were actually increasing my check based on increased income during my probationary period, and it was a silly mistake on my part, but I didn't know. And if somebody from Social Security had been there at that time in my life to explain everything to me, I think I could have avoided that. So, you know, and I, you know, I think among the anxiety and the fear that I hear from a lot of people, it really is that fear of loss of benefits. I mean, that's what I hear mm-hmm. from a lot of my friends who have disabilities. You know, I would love to go back to work, but I need my health care. I need my check. I can't possibly make enough money.
To make it a reasonable trade-off.
Exactly.
I'm not going to use Richard's language. That doesn't sound like a mistake. It sounds more like a misstep to me.
Yeah.
But
thank you,
Christine. What are some of the most common missteps that people with disabilities?
I think that's a really good one, not realizing how work will affect your benefits. Another one is not having what Richard has in spades, which is just the courage and the will to give it a try. Just give it a try. Get some guidance, but give it a try. You can do it.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, in terms of, it sounds like the Social Security thing was something that would have accelerated the learning curve.
Yes.
For you, Richard, what other things along the way would have been useful?
I think knowing how to address the idea of accessibility in the workplace was a big one for me. My first job out of high school was just an epic disaster. It was not a job I was suited for. You know, it required me to have job skills that I just didn't have at that point in my life. And I think part of that is kind of gets down to the idea of transition out of high school into, you know, either college or a workplace. And I just did not have those transition skills.
Was that a condition, though, of being a person with a disability or just being a young person?
Probably a little bit of both. Probably a little bit of both. I am somebody who also greatly outlived my life expectancy. And yeah. So a lot of people didn't think I would ever work. And so when I finally got to that point, I think a lot of people just plain didn't know what to do with me. But there's a lot of people like me in that type of a situation. And I think we're finally getting to the system where we're planning for highest potential instead of disability.
Right. That's right. That's the important thing.
We are talking about the challenges facing people with disabilities and the work of the Indiana Governor's Council for People with Disabilities on No Limits today. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email or find us on social media. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about the work of the Indiana Governor's Council for People with Disabilities. My guests are Christine Dahlberg, who is executive director of the Indiana Governor's Council for People with Disabilities, and Richard Propes, who is a Governor's Council spokesperson. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, track us down on Twitter at wfyi, or you can do what a listener named Ryan has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Hi, Ryan. You're on the air.
Hi, John. Good day to you.
Good day to you. What's on your mind?
I'm wondering, and thanks for hosting this, this and all the other subjects you do, but with your guest today, is there a centralized location that people can go online and find resources available? Because a lot of times, from my own experience, I had a daughter that was born with disabilities, and it would have been impossible to find anything if I didn't have that human help, because there's nothing centralized. You don't know where to search.
How is your daughter doing these days?
She passed away.
Oh,
she was a multivisceral transplant.
Oh, I am so sorry, Ryan.
Thank you. She lived to be 17 months. It was a long story of hope.
Well, you are in my thoughts. Thank you very much for calling and posing the question.
Yeah.
Thank you. Christine, is there a clearinghouse like that, a place where one person can go and find out what services are available? And if not, would that be a good idea?
it would definitely be a good idea. And there is something that's, kind of in the works that combines a little bit of handholding with a really comprehensive system of accessing services through the internet and through a web-based service. But right now it's not up and running yet, and it's not anything that council's directly involved in. I just heard about it, and I can't even recall the name of it right now. But I would say that in the case of the gentleman that called, I would strongly encourage families who have children with new diagnoses to call one of the parent organizations. We have several that are excellent. All of them, the people that run those organizations are families, usually moms, but there's some dads of kids with disabilities who have personal experience in trying to navigate the system. And they're really good at giving people direction who aren't sure what services they need to access and where to go. And so those are those family programs. One of them is, in his case, if he called me and had a question, I would send him straight to Family Voices. They are the premier family organization that answers a lot of questions about children with medical issues and medical conditions. Another really great statewide family organization is ASK, and that it stands for About Special Children, About Special Kids, actually. And they also provide information and training and assistance to parents of children with disabilities. And then the third one I usually recommend if your child is in special education is InSource, and that is Indiana's organization that helps people with children in special education to help them get through the process of becoming eligible for special education, if they have any issues as they're going through school with their individual education plans. And, you know, there's just a lot to it. It's quite complicated. And it's nice to have a family member, a person, either a mom or a dad, that has been through it with their kids to help you as a newly parent with who's been had a new diagnosis, or even if your kid's older and you still you know aren't sure mm-hmm. what you need or where to go, something comes up like and you don't know what to do. They're excellent resources.
And I'm going to ask actually if after we go off the air, since you're tied up here for the next 35 minutes or so. If you wouldn't mind going to our Facebook page and putting the URLs or contact information for all of those organizations,
oh, sure,
so our listeners could go there and find it. And obviously, we'll have some people looking for them as well. Richard, I want to ask, because the other thing that's clear, kind of the subtext of Richard's call is you're in this situation, you're a parent, and you find out that you have a child with disabilities, and you know, at least what I was hearing from in his voice is, you just feel overwhelmed. That you know, there are the practical considerations, but there's also this, oh God, what do I do? How do I serve my child? How do I cope? And all of that, the emotional kind of piece of it. What can we do to provide more support for people in those situations who just feel like, oh, yeah, the world fell on them?
For me, I really think, again, it kind of goes back to the parenting organizations. You know, the idea that getting a reminder that you're not alone, getting parents who have actually walked the walk, that can start, if your child is diagnosed at birth, obviously that can start in the hospital, whether that's the NICU or any of the organizations like, you know, March of Dimes. There's an organization called Neophyte that deals with children who are born with a lot of challenges. But if that's not the case, you know, these organizations, I mean, that's truly what they specialize in, is making sure that parents don't feel alone in this journey. And while they're wonderful in terms of providing resources, for me, what they really provide is community. They don't let people go through the journey alone. And I think that's priceless.
We are talking about the work of the Governor's Council on People with Disabilities here on No Limits today. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. Track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Or do what a listener named Stephen has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Hi, Stephen. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Certainly.
I really enjoy the topics of your shows. I just wanted to call and respond to the previous caller about some disability resources. And there's actually a new website that is being launched in Indiana called IndianaDisabilityResourceFinder.org, or just Finder for short.
We're getting thumbs really up from my guests here in the studio saying that's the one they were thinking of. So
yes, it's a new one, and it compiles a lot of different databases from different providers around the state. And I've actually worked in mental health and developmental disability services for many years. Working on the ground and seeing these people struggle and try to work through all sorts of different issues. You know, the one thing that I see that we're really lacking as a state is proper funding for services, whether that's state or federal or Social Security or whatever. You know, there's lots of community and there's lots of passion from people, but what I see, number one, is, you know, it's really difficult to find high-quality staff to provide help for people with disabilities. And I would love for the state to really invest in that, because all the research shows when people are supported and engaged in their communities, they're productive members of society, and they're much less likely to suffer from abuse, neglect, and exploitation. So that's just what I'd like to say, and I would like to hear more about that if you guys want.
All right. Yeah. We will pose the question. Thank you very much for the call, Stephen, and thank you for the information. So, Richard, I'll start with you. Obviously, the website is a good development. Mm-hmm. But I'm going to throw the larger question, Stephen says, is that we don't throw enough resources at figuring out ways to integrate people in. I'll reframe it ever so slightly, Stephen, if I've done you an injustice, please call back in and we'll let you reframe. But, you know, one of the things that I have seen is that economists have been predicting for some time that the world is heading into a period in which there is going to be a significant labor shortage. Some of the estimates put it as much as 25% by the year 2030. I'm not going to dance around this up. Too often, people with disabilities have been considered as afterthoughts or, you know, pushed away into a corner for consideration later and all of that. Many of the, you know, the indicators, though, are not only is that not necessarily a morally justifiable position or policy, it's also becoming pretty close to economically suicidal because we are going to need all hands on deck in the very near future. So, in that case, what things, if we are going to fully integrate people with disabilities in a world where we want to succeed, we want not just people with disabilities to succeed, but the society to succeed, what kinds of resources should we be committing to that task? Big question, I know.
That's a big question.
It is, but that's why the show is called No Limits, Richard.
Oh, I think that we have to realize that, I think, first of all, by investing in people with disabilities to enter the workforce, we are investing in our community. We are investing in building our community. If that means that we're investing in providing the staff support that someone might need to be successful in a work setting, whether that's short-term or long-term, that it's a worthy investment. If we're talking about making things more accessible, it's a worthy investment. As a community, do we want to be a community that taps into all of the gifts that a person with a disability can bring to the table in the workplace? And I think it's interesting, you know, because we talk about the idea of accommodation, and you know, we do it in our daily lives all the time anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody applies for a job, they have a child at home, they need to leave 30 minutes early. If we value that person, we make that accommodation mm-hmm. because it's valuable and it helps our business. And for a person with a disability, that accommodation may look different, but you know, if that puts somebody into the work setting that is going to do the job well, who's going to represent the company or the agency well, why wouldn't we want to do that? I mean, why wouldn't we want to do that? And fortunately, I think there's more and more companies that are coming to that realization. Mm-hmm. And I certainly believe that Governor Holcomb supports that type of thinking, you know, that, you know, what can we do to better accommodate individuals with disabilities in the workplace, whether that disability is paraplegia or autism or a hearing impairment or a visual impairment, and that doing what we can do to accommodate, even if there's an initial upfront investment or even an ongoing investment, it's a worthy investment because it's a building up of our community. And you know, it's also reaching, 20% of the population has some form of disability. So mm-hmm. you're reaching a wider population of people, and
mm-hmm. I do think Christine. His point, though, also was on the resource end.
Yeah,
that there aren't enough workers to support the people with disabilities who might need assistance in various ways, and they
Which
can't afford to pay them
question.
Enough.
Yeah.
Right. And that has been a big issue, and one that, there have been many attempts to address, because right now people that work in the system, the disability service delivery system, at the direct level where they personally provide some kind of direct service to an adult with a disability, mm-hmm. you know, they're lucky to start at $9.50 an hour. And maybe if they're really lucky, they'll go up to $12 an hour at some point. And that's very difficult, demanding work. It's not easy. Mm-hmm. And if you can get the same money working at Walmart as you can as a direct service professional, what does that say about how we value the people that work with us, that we don't pay them a living wage or enough that they can even avoid food stamps and some of the social supports? So I think that's a huge issue. Mm-hmm. I think certainly money is important, but there's other things we can do, too. We could be more flexible in the way we allow services to be provided. And we can invest in technology. I mean, I love my Alexa. Mm-hmm. Smart homes are the way to go, I think. You don't need someone to turn your lights on and off and adjust your thermostat and even cook your meals. You could do a lot of that if you have a smart home, and they're pretty inexpensive now. So there are things that can be done to add resources to the system. But we just need a little more flexibility and thoughtfulness, I think.
We've got a comment question from a listener named Wendy, who did not wish to go on the air. Wendy says she has an adult child with disabilities, and she did not hear about these resources when her daughter was growing up. Are we getting the word out enough? Also, the sheltered workshops are going away, and there is a world of people who cannot be part of the workforce when the only way to work is in these programs that are disappearing. I saw, Richard, you were pumping your fist on that one, so I'm going to give you the first chance to respond.
it's hard to respond because for me there's a lot of emotion to it. But, you know, I think, again, it kind of comes down to that idea of, are we willing to invest? Asking someone to work for cents on the dollar, even if it's a job that we would determine to be mm-hmm. Menial labor of some sort, which I think is tremendously insulting, but it's...
Okay, so I'm going to tell you something, and I don't want... Mm-hmm. Your listeners probably don't know that sheltered workshops pay people less than minimum wage to work there.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes as little as a quarter an hour.
Yeah.
Sometimes a lot more, but their jobs... And only people with disabilities have these jobs, and they get them through these certificates. And there's 5,000 people in Indiana today working under a sub-minimum wage certificate, making, in most cases, not all, far less than minimum wage for what they do. And that is being looked at the national level for potential changes. I'm not sure where it's going to go, but... I understand that there are people that have worked in sheltered workshops most of their adult lives, mm-hmm. and they don't want to leave. They get a little bit of money, and they have the benefit of their friends being there. But I do think that eventually, over a period of years, you know, not tomorrow, not even next year, or even 5 years from now, we need to move away from that archaic system that. That really values doesn't value the work of people with disabilities. Okay, so this is an example. If you have cerebral palsy that affects your hands, mm-hmm. you're not going to be really good at factory work that requires mm-hmm. eye-hand dexterity. And so you could probably put, you know, 25% mm-hmm. of the work you put in full, you know, all your an hour a time and only get 25% of the work done, then they pay you 25% of whatever the going wage is, say it's minimum wage. Well, why not find the job with a job for the person with cerebral palsy
with the right
that
skill
actually
set. Applies.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep. Fits the school set.
That's
we,
exactly
skill
right.
Set. We are talking about the challenges facing people with disabilities today on No Limits. My guests are Christine Dahlberg and Richard Probst of the Indiana Governor's Council for People with Disabilities. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please, stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about the efforts of the Indiana Governor's Council for People with Disabilities. My guests are Christine Dahlberg, who is executive director of the Governor's Council for People with Disabilities, and Richard Probst, who is a Governor's Council spokesperson. If you want to join the conversation, you can do so in several ways. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what Heather has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Heather, you're on the air.
Yes, I was listening to your show, and I think one thing that unfortunately gets overlooked a lot of times is people with disabilities can also have a disability because they have a mental illness. Mm-hmm. My son is only 8 years old, and he's been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, which is a lifelong illness. And sometimes people, as they get older, are unable to work or maintain a job over the long term. And I know they can rely on things such as disability, although it can be kind of difficult to get. I've also read in the literature if you're able to set up a trust fund for your child. And I just wondered if the guests could talk about that, as well as any parental support groups that they know of for individuals like myself. I have reached out to ASK, and they have been somewhat helpful. I've yet to visit a NAMI group, but I plan on doing that. But I just think there's a lot of parents struggling with these kind of issues, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of communication in the community among professionals about support groups, too. So those are the two issues, the financial problems over the long term and parental support.
And Heather, before I let you go, I know normally you call in and ask the questions. Do you mind if I ask you one real quick?
Yeah, go ahead.
Which is, as a parent who is dealing with that sort of situation, what things or what pieces of information would be the most helpful to you that you don't have? Right now?
Just parent support groups, because I think that from what I've seen, because my son is in an IOP group right now, there's a lot of parents struggling with these kind of issues, and there's a lot of behavioral issues that come with this illness at a young age. And there's not a lot of, like, support as far as, like, sharing with other parents what you're struggling with. Because when you think about having a child, you don't think about your child possibly having a mental illness and what that's going to look like for your family, you know. And so that and, like, the long-term issues, you know, if he, for instance, when he gets older, decides that he doesn't want to take his medication and I'm not around to help him out, I don't want him to end up homeless on the streets. And I think those are some of the harsh realities that there isn't any answers for.
Well, thank you very much for calling and sharing this. And we will take up your two questions or points. But please know that we wish both you and your son well.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Christine.
Yes. There are a lot of disabilities that aren't visible when you look at someone, and they can still significantly have a huge impact on, you know, many things about your life. And I think mental illness is one of the ones that's probably the most tricky, because it can vary. If you have a quadriplegia or a paraplegia or a physical disability like that, you've got what you've got, and it may change with age, but it's not going to fluctuate up and down. You're not going to be able to use your arms one day and not the next day. And with mental illness, though, that can, you know, really be, in a lot of ways, it is a disability. It's something that we need to address. And there are groups that are addressing it, but I don't think they're doing a very good job. I would agree with the woman who called in.
Heather,
The parent support groups aren't there to the extent that they are for children with intellectual disabilities, for example. The parent groups that focus on – there is a children – there is a children's group that focuses on mental illness, and I'll add that to the list of things that I'm going to post on your Facebook page when we're finished. But I'm not sure that they have groups all around the state, for example. And I think that is a real need. Parents need to be able to share with each other. And sometimes that's the biggest need they have.
Well, I'm wondering, as we're talking here, is some of it, too, that, you know, perhaps the designation here is too broad. I mean, we're talking about people with disabilities.
Right.
But, you know, mental illness is different than paraplegia. There are different challenges. It's sort of like, you know, making an assumption that that everyone fits in the same basket. Richard's nodding his head.
Yeah.
I'm going to let you respond to that. The thought is fresh with you.
I just, you know, again, you know, I think it goes back to my statement that, you know, we can't come up with these cookie cutter solutions. Mm-hmm. We've got to be creative because there's going to be different types of disabilities. Someone who's dealing with mental illness is going to be not only have different issues and may not require necessarily accessibility, but they're going to require different supports. They're going to have different community needs. They're going to be really in a different system. You know, whereas, you know, someone who has an intellectual disability or autism might be dealing with the Bureau of Developmental Disability Services. Someone with a mental illness might be, you know, dealing with the Division of Mental Health. They might have an MRO, which is kind of a waiver mental health type support. And so the needs are just incredibly different. And yet, again, they can impact someone's ability to live independently, someone's ability to be in the community, and, you know, how do we support that? And do we choose to support that to build someone up so that they can become more independent and live a meaningful life, whatever that means for them?
Ryan, a listener named Ryan, has posed a question along those lines via Twitter. And again, if you want to join the conversation via Twitter, you can find us at WFYI. Ryan writes, regarding the budget for investing into disability service resources, what type of teeth influence has the council been granted?
Very little.
Okay.
We're involved in a lot of groups and organizations and working on committees and doing small grants and things like that, but we are not in charge of anything except our own agency and our own budget. So we can use little bits of money and our influence on different committees to try to influence the direction that public policy is going in. And of course, we want it to go in the direction of advancing our mission, which is promoting inclusion of people with disabilities in everything, not just work, but all aspects of society. So that's what we do. But it's only through you know, being articulate about the issues, maybe doing a little bit of research or paying for a study or paying for advocacy training. That's the kinds of things that we do to nudge the system along, but we have no direct influence over it.
Go ahead, Richard.
What I think the council does really, really well is that they provide the proof that this stuff can work. They have the people that they support. They have the people who are involved. If you watched the Indiana Disability Awareness Campaign last month, you saw people who are, you know, largely actively working out in the community, out living successful, meaningful lives. And that I think inspires then the community to get more involved. They say, okay, this can work. And so that's what the Governor's Council, to me, does really, really well.
We are talking about the challenges facing people, Hoosiers, with disabilities today on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Greg has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Greg, you are on the air.
Thanks very much.
Certainly.
Hey, Richard, it's your old buddy Greg from the Winona days.
Hey.
I I've also had the pleasure of having professional experience with consumers with both physical and intellectual as well as emotional challenges. And these people, by and large, tended to have caregivers and whatnot. And one, these caregivers couldn't afford to keep doing what they were doing. They weren't making enough income to stay alive while they're trying to do their jobs. Two, there weren't enough of them, which leads me to my second comment. We are not willing to make the investments that we have to make. We're not willing to dedicate the resources that are necessary to provide the appropriate training and residential and general support services that are necessary for these people to meaningfully operate in our social environment. We have to value our workers, and we're not valuing the people that are able-bodied, much less those that have challenges and absolutely require assistance in order to bring their functioning to the level where they can meaningfully participate.
Thanks very much for the call and for sharing your thoughts, Greg. Christine.
Sure.
I agree wholeheartedly that we aren't putting enough resources into paying the caregivers that are needed by folks with disabilities to achieve their best life. I also think we need to invest in people with disabilities directly to achieve their best life through training and education and providing them with durable medical equipment and resources, technology, that kind of thing. There's a lot of things that can be done for people with even the most significant disabilities to have them have more choice and more control over their lives so that their lives aren't governed by what a paid staff person is agreeing or not agreeing to help them with. And so while I do completely agree with what the caller said, I think we have to look at it more broadly than that. But we do need to look at that as well. That is something that a lot of people have brought up over the years, and there has been some improvement. But the fact is that it's not an attractive profession. It's not even a profession. It should be a profession with a career ladder, and people should get into it not just because they're passionate about helping or assisting people with disabilities, but also because they can make a decent living doing it. And that's just not the case now.
Richard, you know, the subtext to a lot of these points has been, you know, a question of dignity, too. You know, that we just do not, all through the system, we do not treat people with disabilities with the dignity they deserve. We do not treat the people who want to help and support people with disabilities with the dignity they deserve. How do we go about addressing that?
I think it really involves almost a social shift, a cultural shift. I think that far too often we see it as offering a handout instead of a hand up. And, you know, I think that we need to shift that. I think that sometimes there's an assumption that, you know, when we're putting money into those kinds of supports and systems, that it's just – It's not going anywhere, you know. It's just a handout, and it's not. And to see it as empowering people with disabilities to live, again, more meaningful lives, more independent lives, to work to their highest potential, some have the potential to, you know, eventually, perhaps not need the system, to. Some will always need some mm-hmm. supports from the system. And so but I think it really just it involves, first of all, that cultural shift of, you know, we're actually empowering people. We're building people up.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Beth. And again, if you want to join the conversation via email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Beth writes, as far as sheltered workshops and lowered wages, I have adult nieces who have cerebral palsy. If they get a job, they cannot earn over a certain amount of money without losing their Social Security and other benefits. So while one is more able to than the other to work, she can't find a good job without losing all her benefits. The government puts people with disabilities in a position where they are damned if they do and damned if they don't. As soon as they see you can earn money, your benefits drop off, regardless of whether you are able to earn enough to survive. They have to be either fully dependent on the government or fully independent. Seems to me that's the point you've been trying to make to some degree, Christine, during this conversation, that the system needs to be far more sophisticated and subtle.
It does. However, even at the far end of the work incentives package, there are many work incentives. You can you could, for example, her daughter with cerebral palsy, if she needs personal care assistance, she could pay for that and take it straight off the top. Wouldn't affect the level of her benefits. If she needed somebody to drive her to work, she could take that straight off the top. I mean, there's just so many things that could be done to help her get a job and not lose her benefits. Or lose her benefits, why not? If you're making $2 for every dollar in benefits you lose, then it's a win for you, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, I think the at least the argument I heard Beth advancing, though, is you're in a situation where if you make 60% of what your benefits would provide, you still lose your benefits or can lose your benefits. And that creates a real disincentive for people to go back to work.
Right. And that's why they have work benefits counselors. They have counselors that can go through with you and look at your specific situation and what you're getting and what you need in order to live and help you calculate that and work through it so you know what their actual effect will be rather than just a fear mm-hmm. that something might happen.
We're getting close on time here toward the end of the program. And again, I want to reiterate that, you know, this conversation will continue after we go off the air on Facebook. There are going to be some resources placed there for people because clearly there are people who have questions and concerns here. But I'm going to ask each of you, what is one concrete change we could make, either in public policy or just the way we approach this, that would help people with disabilities? I'll start with Richard first, and you've got about 20 seconds.
I think for me, it would be simply creating more tangible opportunities for people with disabilities to actually sample the workforce, create something that gets them out in the community, gives them the opportunity to try things, to learn things, and really give someone the ability to kind of confront the anxiety and the fear.
Christine, you've actually got about 15.
Okay, well, so I'd say changing people's attitudes toward folks with disabilities and having them treat people with respect and expect them to be successful adults. To me, that's one of the biggest barriers.
And that will have to be the last word until we take this over to Facebook. I'd like to thank my guests, Christine Dahlberg and Richard Probst of the Governor's Council for People with Disabilities. I'd like to thank our listeners, as usual, for some great questions. Invite everybody to come back on Thursday when we're going to be talking with Senator Todd Young. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.